I'm Daniel Gross, Executive Editor of Strategy and Business. Welcome to our podcast, Talking My Book. Every 2 weeks, we sit down with authors of exciting new books on business, economics, management, and globalization to have a conversation. Today, our guest is Joanne Lublin, who is one of the most distinguished management writers around. In her long career with the Wall Street Journal, she has run the paper's London Bureau, created its first career advice column in 1993, shared in a 2003 Pulitzer Prize for stories about corporate scandals. She's currently the management news editor at the Journal. Her new book is Earning It, Hard-Won Lessons from Trailblazing Women at the Top of the Business World. It's published by Harper Business, and we're grateful that it has brought her to our studios high above Park Avenue. Joanne, welcome.
Thank you. I was the deputy bureau chief in London, not the bureau chief.
Okay, we gave you a retroactive promotion.
Would have been lovely.
So I enjoyed the book a great deal, and I recommend it to our listeners. You interviewed, over the course of this, 52 women at mostly very senior level at the corporate world. And you cover a lot of hot button issues, tensions of parenting, the dynamics of couples where both have careers, sexual harassment. How did you get the idea to write this book?
Well, I got the idea to write this book out of a personal essay that I did for the Wall Street Journal back when we had a blog. It was called Journal Women. And I wrote this essay in order to try and explain to my daughter the ways of the world. She was relatively new in the workforce at that point. And so the point of the essay, which was called Remember the Barriers, was to just look at some of the obstacles and evidence and forms of gender bias that I had encountered early in my journalism career. And out of that came the book idea.
Now, let's set the stage. On the one hand, women are in charge of some of the most important institutions and companies in our country. Federal Reserve, IBM, GM, HP. And yet you document early on this kind of litany of progress being very slow, the very low percentage of women in top management ranks. So how should we think about this situation? Is this the beginning of an inevitable wave? Or are there still these very significant barriers that are inhibiting the people who are more than half our workforce from being all they can be?
I think it's both. I think there have been significant gains for women in the workforce and in particular in management. The gains really haven't come at the top of the house, however. As of the Fortune magazine's latest list of Fortune 500 companies that came out in June, there were only 21 women running Fortune 500 companies, and that was down from where it had been in 2014 and 2015.
And I think that, you know, some of this, when you see regression like this, in our CEO study, 2015, only 3% of the new CEOs hired by the world's 1,200 largest companies were women. That was the lowest proportion since 2011.
And it was worse in your study for North America than it was for the world as a whole.
And I think a lot of people thought it was just a matter of time and evolution. As new generations come in, the barriers will fall and things will change.
And yet a lot of studies show that millennial men have some of the same stereotypical attitudes towards women that their fathers and grandfathers had.
So
what we've got here is what some people call second generation bias, this notion that we have men and women alike have unconscious bias of what we think of you need to do to be a successful leader. And it's okay to be aggressive if you're a guy, but if you're aggressive as a woman, you tend to be seen as bossy.
Now, one of the I think things that really recommend your book to people is, obviously you have data, you cite studies, but what you're really doing is telling the stories and gleaning insights from women who, people who follow business news probably know quite well, and we learn a lot of stuff about them. And you use their experience to kind of organize this thematically. One of your chapters, the headline is Bloom Where You're Planted, which is the idea that you kind of get in where you can and you got to make the most of it. Tell me about Anne Mulcahy, because she was a pioneer. She became the CEO of Xerox at a time when there were very few women CEOs. And she took a job, which, you know, sounds dreadful, selling copiers in Maine.
Right. And it was a really thankless assignment because it was one of their worst performing states in the country. And yet, that job was the result of her raising her hand a half a dozen times to get into a management role because she'd been a sales rep for the company for several years. And she was convinced because she was unmarried and a woman that this was somehow being held against her. Of course, she had no proof of that. And then the guy who finally gave her this role really had nobody else to give it to, but he also was reluctant to have her do it because not only did she have to somehow bring this region back from the precipice, but she had to manage a team of men who had never worked for a woman before. Again, this was a while ago. This was the late 70s.
Again, you do have a lot of the stories start with people getting in on the ground floor in an unlikely way, you know, badgering someone for an opening, taking a secretary job when they were overqualified for it, accepting lower pay.
Which happened with Beth Mooney. Beth Mooney became the very first woman chief executive of a major U.S. SNL, and her first job out of college with a college degree was as a secretary at a bank.
Harper Business, the publisher of Joanne Lublin's book, Earning It, Hard-Won Lessons from Trailblazing Women at the Top of the Business World, has provided us with two copies of the book, which the author has signed, and we'll be giving those away. If you're interested in entering a drawing for a free copy, send an email to gross_daniel@strategy-business.com. That's gross_daniel@strategy-business.com. Should people setting out in their careers still expect that they should take a job for which they are not qualified, or that they should take a job at a lower salary that other people are earning for the sake of getting in the door?
My advice, if that request came from a woman as opposed to a man, would be to think long and hard about where that's going to get you, both in terms of your experience, in terms of your long-term career goals, in terms of how you are perceived. So, for instance, Kathy Black, who's another woman that I interviewed for the book, some of the jobs...
had a very successful career in media.
Correct. But some of the early jobs that she was applying for were basically secretarial positions, and she wasn't willing to sort of have that label on her face. And so she took a job where I think her title was advertising assistant or something like that. She was selling ads for a travel magazine. But she felt that at least it looked better from a professional development standpoint. And so I think you got to do your homework as to whether this is the route that successful men have gone.
Right. And you talk about that in the book. And I think one of the things that makes this book really come to life is that it's not just the stories of famous women who became CEOs. There's a lot of your personal story interspersed in there.
There are stories.
Tell me about your first job was in the San Francisco, when you hired on the San Francisco Bureau.
I was the very first woman hired as a reporter for that bureau. So there were six male reporters and a male bureau chief. And when I got to the bureau right after finishing grad school, I noticed several of the men had pinup calendars above their desks, which were basically calendars that had scantily clad women for every month. You know, there was Miss July and Miss June and whatnot. So obviously they weren't going to take it down just to please me. So I went out and bought a calendar with scantily clad men. It lasted 24 hours, and it mysteriously disappeared. And then when I left the bureau, got transferred to Chicago, the farewell card that all the men in the bureau signed was a picture of a male nude actor with his hand carefully placed over his private parts, and they all signed his hand as goodbye.
Very nice. I guess the question I have is, and maybe media, you know, I guess we shouldn't think too highly of our own industry, but I've always, in the workplace, had, from the beginning of my career, had bosses who are women and colleagues who are women. You know, is the cup sort of half empty or two-thirds empty when it comes to women being able to sort of show up to work and be treated as a professional?
Well, I'm an eternal optimist, so I've always believed that the cup is half full. And I think one of the reasons for my optimism about this issue is that we're starting to see some headway, not in terms of the number of women as CEOs, but the number of women getting into senior management. And I recently wrote a piece about this for our Women in the Workplace section, which came out a couple of weeks ago. And it was about the fact that when you have a significant number of women reporting to the male CEO, not only do practices change, but attitudes change. And this whole notion that it's okay to leave work in the middle of the day to go deals with something having to do with your child becomes a lot more socially acceptable because there are multiple women doing it. And then it's okay for the guys to do it as well. And I think at the end of the day, what's going to make that half full glass come up a little bit is the fact that men recognize this is really in their self-interest. Their jobs are not at stake to the extent women are getting ahead because women pull up talented men as well as talented women.
Another kind of recurring issue, and it pops up not just in the corporate world but also in the pop culture, is maternity leave. We are having, I think, for the first time, a conversation about the, you know, why it is that we don't have paid leave in this country when so many others do. So where are we? Are we breaking any new ground in a new type of understanding of parents taking off when they have children? or not?
This is an issue where I think the glass is about 25% full. And yet, 2 or 3 years ago, it would have been 10% full. And what's changing here is the realization that you need to make it possible to be a successful parent and a successful manager. And that has to be true for the men and for the women. For years, companies have offered forms of paternity leave, usually unpaid, but no man in his right mind would ever take it because you would be seen as somehow not committed to your career. I think you're seeing a lot more companies, not a huge number, but particularly in the tech sector, that are extending parental leave to both genders and to some extent paid leave for the guy. And at the same time, you've seen a couple of companies where they're subsidizing to have the nanny go on business trips with the mom who's come back to work. This reintegration after parental leave is also critical, and some companies are addressing too. But it's still way too few.
Right. I think one of the problems with what you're describing is that women are more than half the workforce. They're more than half the people who have college degrees in the U.S. So if you want the best talent, you're going to have more than half women, you know, at your entry level anywhere. And then what we see is that we lose them as they get to middle management, et cetera. So who's doing that well that can be replicated? You know, if GE was the progenitor of Six Sigma that everybody else picked up, are there companies that you can point to that are doing great jobs with women that others might look at and say, you know what, let's look at some of what they're doing and see to what degree we can replicate it here?
Again, good question. I can only speak to the reporting I did for the book. I'm sure there are many, many more examples than the ones I talked to for the book. But one of the examples I do cite in the book is Kelly Services, run by a male CEO. Mm-hmm. And he, early on in his career as chief executive, was struck by the fact, by this very question. He basically made this a personal priority. He got very involved with the Women's Network. He got very involved with mentoring and sponsoring high-potential women. He made sure his direct reports took this seriously. So do several of the women CEOs that I interviewed for the book. They tied people's bonuses on their senior management team to what they were doing in terms of diversifying their own teams. And so, you know, what you pay for is what you get at the end of the day.
Is there any either evidence from studies or from your anecdotal reportage that shows that companies that are, you know, aware that they are marketing, that their main constituency is women, do a better job at promoting, hiring, empowering senior women executives?
Right. And again, I think this is anecdotal because I have not done any systematic study of this, but both in the reporting for the book as well as in the reporting for this piece on top women for our Women in the Workplace section, that was certainly my impression. Kimberly Clark was one of the companies that I wrote about in that piece, where their customers are overwhelmingly women, and the recognition that you need to have women in senior management and get more in the pipeline has been something they've been living with for a long time. I think it has taken a while to get meaningful numbers, but they do. They have a high percentage of women reporting to the CEO.
When you look at, you know, running a Fortune 500 company it's 100 hours. It's an all-consuming job. You have all these stakeholders. You have investors to worry about, suppliers. It's incredibly competitive. It is, you know, 10 years are shortening, right? If you get 3 or 4 years, that's pretty good. Do you, or should we expect something different from women CEOs of large organizations, i.e. to be spending more time talking about, advocating, allocating more resources to development of women executives? Do they have some sort of special obligation?
I'm not sure they have a special obligation unless they feel strongly about the issue. I would hope they would feel that personal obligation. And frankly, the overwhelming response that I got to this book in terms of getting women to participate tells me that there are a lot of female CEOs out there who are current or past CEOs who feel very passionate about this subject, and even once they step down as CEOs, continue to be committed to doing whatever they can, whether it's as a corporate board member or as a speaker or to whatever next chapter their life takes them to. But there are other women who are CEOs who turn me down because they see themselves as a CEO first, last, and always, and they don't want to play the woman card. And that's fine.
Earlier this year, as part of Strategy and Business's big package on the annual CEO Succession Study, we ran an article about women in the corner office under the headline 2015, not the year of the woman CEO. Our study found that in 2015, less than 3% of the new CEOs hired by the world's 1,200 largest companies were women, the lowest proportion since 2011. The article is by Deanna Geer, Parola Carlson, and Gary Nielsen, and it can be found at strategy-business.com. So, you know, in your book, you interview a lot of kind of blue chip CEOs that, again, anyone who reads the Wall Street Journal would sort of know their name. But there are also plenty of people here who I had not heard of. Can you tell us the story of one person who is not a sort of blue chip, A-list name, but you feel whose story is particularly compelling?
I think Chalice Lowe's story is very compelling. She's been a chief human resource officer of three blue chip public companies. And of all 52 women that I interviewed for the book, she's the one I've known the longest because I wrote a front page story about her when she was in her late 20s and was the first African-American female branch manager at Continental Bank in Chicago, where I was then working for the Wall Street Journal. And this is the late 70s. This was a really hard role for her to play. She was also a working mom. She had gotten into the banking industry after being a teacher. She was married at that time. That marriage did not survive. I caught up with her many, many years later when I did a career column about her. I had read about her in USA Today because at that point she was working for Ryder System, and USA Today did a story about Fortune 500 companies where two or more women were among the highest paid executives, and they were one of them because she was the CHRO there. So I wrote a column about what had happened to her career in the intervening 30 years. I think what is most admirable about Chalice is that both as in front of the house as well as behind the scenes, she took it upon herself as a CHRO to advance the cause of women. And in many cases, these women didn't even know that she was arguing that they needed to be paid at a comparable level to the men when they got into senior management. Those are the unsung heroines that are on many of the pages of the book.
Lastly, we're running short on time. Your concluding chapter is the title of it is a question, which is, will the glass ceiling ever shatter? And is that a rhetorical question? Is that said with some sort of irony that, 30 years from now, my daughter and your kids will be having the same conversation?
As I've said, I am the half full glass view of the world. I do think that the glass ceiling will shatter. It's obviously taken longer than anyone expected, but that day will come.
Okay. Well, that's all the time we have for today. I want to thank our guest, Joanne Lublin, for joining us. Her book is Earning It, Hard-Won Lessons from Trailblazing Women at the Top of the Business World. The publisher is Harper Business. Joanne, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome.